Our next guest holds one of the top IT jobs in the country and is one of the few women to hold a high-ranking technology position at a major telecommunications company in New Zealand. Sandra Pickering is Technology Director at Vodafone, responsible for its network and its information technology. Vodafone New Zealand's been in the news over various issues lately. It was the biggest customer lined up by Pacific Fibre for that company's now abandoned plans to construct a second cable between New Zealand and the United States. Also, been in the news for its impending purchase of Telstra Clear, a proposal currently being considered by the competition watchdog, the Commerce Commission. Vodafone's also just recently stopped IT offshore contracting in India, bringing that work back to New Zealand. Well, Sandra Pickering's career began in banking and insurance before a long stint with the computer company IBM, and then taking up her current role at Vodafone 4 years ago? 5 years ago. 4 years ago, I think. Sandra's in the Wellington studio. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Catherine.
I know, it's a pretty busy schedule. Well, now, he's a total Luddite. We're actually learning a few things of late, I have to say. But what does your job at Vodafone actually do when IT peeps go to work? Especially in really senior roles, what do you do?
So I have a team of around 400 staff, and we collectively are responsible for ensuring Vodafone's network and IT systems are up and available for our customers. So it involves everything from the operational side of our network to the operational side of our IT systems and platforms for customers and for our staff to ensure that we can provide the service end-to-end for customers and what they expect from Vodafone.
And your skills, your track record of specific IT skills to get to this point includes what?
Basically, my track record is all about experience. So I started in the industry when I was 17 and basically have learnt all of my skills on the job through various roles, through various parts of my career. So it's basically, it was about entering the industry at a time where it was still new, still evolving, and I guess I was lucky from the perspective that I joined a company that was willing to train me, and as the industry evolved, I was able to evolve my skills.
Did you start the IT when you were in the insurance industry,
yes,
actually? So you started with the most basic things like controlling some computer desktop,
yeah,
old-fashioned.
Well, even more basic than that, I was a tape operator, so I used to work the night shift changing the big tape reels on the old big mainframe systems.
God, it sounds like radio, and we used to do our reel-to-reel editing. That was good fun, guys, wasn't it? We kind of missed that. But it was that basic. It was barely even new technology, was it?
Absolutely.
So then as you progressed, what new technologies came on board and how did you upskill?
So as the IT industry evolved, as computers became more prevalent in the industry, I then moved into training as a programmer, a systems programmer, and you know, as the technology evolved, PCs came in, became more prevalent across the industry. My skills changed with that, and I got into the telecommunications industry. And basically, from that perspective, I learnt about the industry. I did various roles. I got offered some management training and positions, and then was able to build my skills experience. Went overseas for an extended period of time with IBM. I was able to then evolve as the industry evolved. And then eventually I came back to New Zealand where I picked up from where I left off with IBM and then got offered the role at Vodafone.
What comes after programming? Because changing tapes is one thing.
That's right.
Programming is very different. It requires, you know, a whole different language and an understanding of computer science and everything else. And then when you got into the other areas, again, how did the technology keep training on you? How did you have to, what new things did you then have to learn?
So basically, as you know, there was a big period of, you know, through the 80s and 90s where technology was evolving around the IT industry. So basically, you know, when you're in the industry, you have to learn and evolve as the industry changes. So you know, I started, you know, programming on IBM System 32s or whatever they were at the time. I can hardly remember what they were now.
Looked like something out of Doctor Who.
Absolutely, huge things that filled a whole room.
Mm.
Right? The same processing power now sits in a very small device that you can hold in your hand. So, you know, as that evolved, you basically have to keep up with the technology. You know, I started from a technical perspective. I learnt to be a programmer. Then I moved into more of the business side, was a business analyst. Then moved into some project management type skills, then into management.
Even though the management began to take over, does it still require you to know how everything works?
Oh, absolutely. I think it fundamentally changes your view as a manager if you do have some technical knowledge and capability. I mean, you have to make judgment calls on things. You have to know how to assess other people's skills to do their jobs. But obviously, you know, as you evolve from a management perspective, you can't know everything about everything. So you do have to start to rely on other people's knowledge and skills. But, you know, having an overall understanding of the technology, I think it's a very imperative part of the job.
In some ways, and we'll touch now on two areas. One is whether we've got enough skilled IT people full stop in New Zealand, and the second is why it is there seem to be so few women. Actually, I was at a social function just recently with a really interesting bunch of guys, and they were all guys, and I was saying, why aren't there more women? I mean, I'm very happy, thank you, but why aren't there more women in this room? And same thing, they're saying they just don't start on the ground floor. They just don't enter the industry in the numbers that guys do. So in some ways, that break with the insurance company just set you on your path, no barriers, it just happened.
It just happened. I think if I look back on my career and I look at what happens now, I think there's a couple of things. In talking to young women that do end up in places like Vodafone or IBM, whatever, I think they do have the view that, through the school system and process, there needs to be much more awareness of what sort of jobs and careers are available in this industry, both, in companies like Vodafone, but in the wider IT sector. I think women are, or young women are put off by the fact they think it's all very, very technical and very geeky. There are women that do those types of jobs, but from an industry perspective, it's so much more. There are so many more career paths and jobs that are non-technically specific.
But we've seen that with someone like Teresa Gatting heading telecom, but she came from the marketing background.
Absolutely.
So what is it about IT itself that is proving to have some kind of barrier, whether it's an attraction or a perception barrier, for girls and women?
My personal view, it's to do with education and awareness. I think we need to be getting into schools when girls are 13, 14 and 15 and making them aware of the opportunities that sit within this industry in its broader sense, to make it more attractive, for them to understand the difference in, purely technical careers or, management careers or business careers within the industry, because there are so many opportunities. That's what I personally think. And I think, waiting till people have graduated from university or potentially are in other roles before we try and attract women into the industry,
it's too late. What about the education system generally, whether it's male or female students, in gearing people up? Because it's not even a separate industry anymore. This is pervasive through all our industries. What are your views on whether we have got that curriculum right, or the way we try and teach the precursors to this career in our secondary schools, or at primary schools for that matter?
Absolutely. I mean, technology has become more and more pervasive, and the people that are the biggest users of it are generally the younger generation. So I think there is a big awareness about technology and what it does and what it can do for people. I think my view about the education system is we do need to gear it more to awareness of, as I said before, awareness of what careers are available and what opportunities are available.
What do they need at school, though? What are the primary subjects or skills or thinking capacities and abilities that are needed to set you on your path in IT?
For me, it's the basics. It's maths, it's science, it's English. It's the real basics, because if you think about IT, it's, primarily built around logic. It's built around being able to think things through end to end. I think there are so many options now available. If you look at the NCA curriculum, there are so many options, and I think students get confused about what paths to take, which will lead them to different types of careers. So I think at secondary school, there needs to be a much more laid out view from counsellors and career advisors and teachers as to what to guide students about what subjects they should be taking if they're thinking about career in IT or the wider ICT.
They're adding up the numbers, but they're not necessarily adding up the right pathways.
Yeah, and I think it is a fact that we have become, there are a much broader range of subjects for students to choose from to get to the end goal of NCA level 1, 2 and 3. When I was at school, it was primarily based around the core subjects of English, maths and sciences.
It's not only the telecoms companies that are finding this. We were speaking recently to the boss of Orion Health, who said that regrettably around half of his staff, IT staff, he's had to employ from overseas, not by choice, but because the pool of available talent, skilled talent, wasn't in New Zealand. Would that be a common story?
I think it is. We've gone out recently, as you said in your introduction, and brought a large number of jobs back to New Zealand, and we are having trouble finding male or female the right level of skills to put into those roles. I think two things have happened in the industry. I think we have stopped training people from the ground up. You know, there's a tendency to hire from a graduate pool of people, but I also think there's a much bigger untapped pool of talent from the secondary school leaver group.
You're talking about apprenticeships, in effect.
Yeah, internships, apprenticeships, you know, training from the ground up, which
is what I experienced. It's interesting to hear you say that. I mean, what would a company like Vodafone do with a brand new school graduate who hadn't been through, I don't know, a comm science degree or whatever?
So it's something that we're actively looking at doing, introducing. So we've got two programs that we are running. One is a graduate program where we look for, you know, computer science graduates or engineering graduates to work on our network side of the house. But from an IT perspective, there are a number of roles we believe we can get school leavers into as part of an internship program, working with industry groups like ETITO, places like that, to get, and then as part of their training, have them do more formal training, you know, to get a certificate in a subject that they're interested in, which will lead them into a broader IT career. And, you know, to be honest, the productivity of those types of people is hugely rewarding. When I see it, they're so eager to learn, but they're also so savvy with technology. So I think there is a great pool of untapped talent that we need to get in and make it viable for companies like Vodafone and others in the industry to be able to bring these people in, train them, and then set them on their way in terms of their overall career.
How interesting. Now, I've got three questions about it. First, are they more savvy because they're just younger? And there's actually a four-year gap between what a 22-year-old might know and what an 18-year-old might know right now.
Yeah, look, I think they bring different things to the table. You know, we've had a great success with our graduate hire program. We've got some stunning young people into our business, both males and females, and I'm really excited about that. They bring a different dynamic to the company. They have no barriers. They have no learned behaviours in terms of what works and what doesn't. They test everything. You know, there's no rules, so that's fantastic.
This is what you need.
Absolutely.
In an industry like this, people who go outside of the square.
Are you saying
in some ways the university training can risk, in some cases, taking the edge off that kind of freedom?
I don't think so. I think it depends. You know, let's say the graduates that we've brought in do bring that dynamic into our company. We've also looked at, you know, bringing students in at 18, 19, 20 years old who may have work experience in another part, in another industry, but really do want to work in a technology company like Vodafone. And, you know, they bring some level of experience which is potentially different from graduate. I don't think one size necessarily fits all. Not having come through that university training myself, I think I've got a different view potentially than, you know, more traditional views. Everything has to be university-based.
You use the word productivity, though, and are you saying that in some ways you see faster growth in that in the school graduate than necessarily the university graduate?
I do think so. I think there's definitely room for both in our industry. If I look at where jobs will come from in the future, if you think about, you know, where we're at with unemployment and our future, I think the technology industry is going to be more and more viable as career options. I don't see a point in time where we won't need those skills. We'll need different skills, and as the industry evolves, you know, the skills will be different. But, you know, everything is so now technology-based. I think it's a huge opportunity that New Zealand needs to really get on top
of. Do you bond the school graduates that you bring in?
No.
So they stay because they're motivated to stay.
Absolutely. And the tendency is if people do leave, more often than not, if they've had a great experience and they go overseas, they'll come back. Yeah, I'm not sure bonding is the right vehicle.
One of the interesting things we mentioned in the introduction is that you have brought this offshoring of IT contractors. You've brought the whole process back to New Zealand. And what drove that decision?
A couple of things. We obviously are always looking at how do we do things more productively, how do we create a better experience for our customers, and how do we manage our costs as a business. What we found was by controlling more of the customer-facing processes ourselves, we could actually do things in a much more productive way, and we wanted to have the core IP of our business with our own staff in New Zealand.
Does this mean actually going on site sometimes, or does it simply mean that a New Zealand-based contractor just got the problem resolved quicker?
Absolutely. And you don't deal with the issues of time zones, you don't deal with the management overhead of having to manage a remote workforce. The productivity, in my view, goes up.
It's very interesting because I thought we were hearing the beauty of contracting offshore is that, you know, 24 hours availability and never closes down, all this kind of thing. There were the price attractions as well, the cost of labour attractions as well. That wasn't your experience.
In this particular case, no. I don't think that's a generic statement, though. I think there are functions of business that can be performed offshore and done well. What we have found, however, is, you know, you need to pick those things pretty carefully, and some things are just not as suitable as other things. And we found that our core IT, developing our core IT and managing our core IT platforms that our customers use will be more efficient and more productive for us doing it locally in New Zealand with our own staff.
Just before we leave the question of women in IT, and particularly in senior positions, have you got on your own staff a higher or better, in inverted commas, gender balance than many other companies, or are you fighting the same battle?
I think, to be perfectly honest, I think we're fighting the same battle. We've probably got more focus on it than some other companies, but I think generally, you know, the industry is looking for ways to address that imbalance, but it's a long-term game. It's not something that you can address over a 2 or 3 year period. I think you have to have policies and practices in place that will start to drive the balance from the bottom up. It's a numbers game. You know, we definitely need more women coming in to roles much earlier in their careers so they can be sustained for a longer period of time and therefore be available to, you know, to do the types of job that I'm doing, for example.
That's interesting because you're talking about a career there. And another thing that we often anticipate with new generations coming forward into the workforce is the expectation of flexibility. Just ask you how many hours a week you work. I know you commute between Wellington and Auckland. Is the industry, whether it is for male or female staff, adapting to the idea that people don't want to work 80 or 100 hours a week to get to the top anymore, and adapting to the fact that they've got family commitments and might want flexible working hours, those kinds of things?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be imperative, and I think it's the big area of focus for us is creating that flexible environment, and it especially addresses a lot of the concerns that women have around having careers in this type of industry. You know, if you look at the types of tools now that we've got available, and as a telco, we should be leading the pack on that. You know, we've got smartphone access with email, we've got tablets, we've got video conferencing. There are a whole raft of things that enable us, you know, to not have to be desk bound 9 to 5, to be able to do our work outside of the normal business hours, and to be able to balance work and family life. I don't think it necessarily means we have to work more hours. I think the hours that we work with the tools that we've now got available can be far more productive.
Have you introduced some specific initiatives? Can people work on flexi time?
Absolutely.
Are there crash facilities available at the work, or because you've got the ability to work remotely, do you presume that might be how it's managed?
Look, I think there's a number of things there, a number of things to address. One is, you know, for instance, Vodafone, every single staff member, no matter what job you do, has a smartphone, which means they have access to systems, to email, to people, wherever they are. So that allows a degree of flexibility. Obviously, some jobs you have to be there, depending on the type of role that you do. But for example, in my job, you know, I've got a staff of, you know, over 400 people, most of them based around the Auckland region, but I do spend a large amount of my time in Wellington. Now, how do I manage that? Video conferencing, meetings, doing, you know, catching up on my work in the evenings once all the, you know, the family stuff is done.
And is that kind of flexibility available to most staff?
It's getting more and more available to a wider range of staff. And I think what has to happen for that to be effective is it has to be led from the top. You know, we've got a CEO, for example, that is very family oriented. So he's very conscious about creating a flexible work environment for his team. And then I think it then filters down into the organisation.
I'm speaking to Sandra Pickering. She is Head of Technology, Director of Technology at Vodafone. It's 29 minutes past 10 on 9 to noon. A long stint at IBM before Vodafone, and how important was that in getting you where you got?
Hugely. I mean, it formed the bulk of my career, nearly 20 years. And the thing that I think really helped me out there was I spent a lot of time overseas. So the overseas experience, being able to work in different, basically different environments, having to manage, you know, time zones back to New Zealand, having to manage people remotely, it was a huge experience for me, and I certainly wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now without that experience.
And had a software focus, that role as well.
It was an IT focused job.
What has been the biggest challenge since you've joined Vodafone? We've just outlined some of the very recent challenges it's dealing with and changes it's dealing with, but what have been the biggest ones you've faced in your role?
Without a doubt, the Christchurch earthquake and what that meant for our customers and staff in Christchurch, having to ensure that we were able to provide communication service through a very challenging period for that community, and the work that was involved with dealing with our people down there. And I went down there and worked with them for 3 weeks following the earthquake. It changes your whole focus when you're dealing with that type of situation versus the things that you deal with on a daily basis as part of the job that I do.
How was the network affected and how did you deal with it?
If we look at what happened straight after the earthquake, our network stood up pretty well. We were able to continue to provide a range of services, albeit on a reduced scale through that period of time. We lost a number of sites due to severe building damage in the city. And the biggest issue that we had was power. So, we had to get mobile generators to cell sites so we could continue to operate the network. But, all in all, it stood up pretty well. We probably lost, a much smaller portion of sites than we could have. But we were able to keep the network, running in some capacity throughout the whole period of time, immediately after the event and in the weeks following.
It was a time of cooperation among companies that typically fiercely compete as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the time when everything just gets put aside and, we were working across the industry to share assets like generators, share information about locations of sites that were damaged. Huge cooperation, not just within the industry, but with government, civil defence, search and rescue and things like that to make sure that, it didn't matter who was affected or whose customers, we worked together to ensure that we could provide a service for the people of Christchurch.
Has it had an impact on the mobile market or the provision of services in Christchurch, the quakes and the experience of the quakes?
Look, I think what it did was brought into stark contrast how communications have evolved and what reliance people do now have on mobile communications. A lot of people, it now becomes their primary vehicle for communication versus landlines. What we found post-earthquake is people tended to uptake more of our smartphone services because, from a smart single device, they could now access the internet to get information. They could, do all the stuff they could do on their landline, but also be mobile and have it because people were moving around a lot. I think it really did change people's focus on having, the right level of mobile service. And, I think that forever that part of the industry, has definitely changed people's lives.
Speaking of infrastructure, the news earlier this month that the planned Pacific Fibre cable project's been shelved and Vodafone had been on board with that as a core customer. Do you have a plan B for the fact that infrastructure's not going to be available to you and give you the sort of freedoms it was to compete that it was going to give you?
Look, I think our perspective on all that was, we were very supportive of Pacific Fibre, hence we signed up as one of the early customers on board for that service. And the reason we did that was we saw a huge opportunity for that to provide competition. Our job, our core business is not to build cables like that. But, I think what we viewed was that it would have brought a lot more competition and therefore, a different dynamic to the industry, which is primarily sourced out of one provider today. So, we were definitely disappointed, but not something that we would, anticipate doing ourselves at all.
Prices for consumers had been coming down and increases in data caps have been happening in anticipation of it going ahead. So what happens now?
I think there will still be a drive in the same direction. I think the current providers, will have to continue to, improve the pricing so we can, provide the types of services that, consumers want in New Zealand. And I think, the industry itself will continue to ensure that, there is competition in that space.
You're still a price taker, effectively, though, aren't you, on infrastructure?
We are. That's true.
One of the Pacific Cable team, as you've just alluded, Sam Morgan, suggested Vodafone may have to pick up the ball and do something itself, re-getting another cable. I'm hearing you saying we're not into building infrastructure like that, but is it being considered either with or without partners? Has it been considered?
It's not to my knowledge. I mean, globally, Vodafone may look at it, but from a New Zealand perspective, I think we've got enough things to focus on right now.
Are our links stable? Speaking of what happened in Christchurch, and I know there's a dual cable going across the Pacific, but whether it's the Pacific or Trans-Tasman to Australia, Do we have enough protection of that critical infrastructure?
Look, I think it's a situation where, you know, you can always have more. I think we're, you know, pretty confident that the services that we have now are well protected. But, you know, the reason we were so keen on Pacific Fibre was that it's another alternative. And, you know, I don't think you can never predict what may or may not happen from an infrastructure point of view in the, you know, events like Christchurch, of course. So, you know, I don't think you can never say you've got enough of anything. But I think we feel pretty confident that what we've got is good. But it could have been better, and, you know, with Pacific Fibre, I think we would have been in a really good position.
Do you think anyone else is going to give it a go?
I think the difficulty is making the economics work. And I think where Pacific Fibre ran into problems with, you know, being able to get the funding required, I think everyone else will be up for the same. It's whether someone, you know, from offshore will come in and provide that service as well.
We're small fry though, aren't we? What are the biggest challenges coming up from Vodafone from a technical perspective? I imagine one of them is you just don't know. You know, but what are the ones you do know of?
Oh, look, you know, I think technology is evolving at such a rapid pace that, you know, telcos have always got the challenge of, you know, what to invest in, how much to meet the market. You know, I think New Zealand has always been early adopters of technology. You know, there's all the discussion about next generation network, 4G, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's our next big challenge.
You're on 2G and 3G presently.
Yeah.
And wanting to shift to 4G.
We've got a you know, a very big roadmap around our 3G network. The speeds that we are getting off 3G today, you know, are double what our nearest competitor can get. So, you know, I see still a long life for 3G as we go forward, but definitely 4G is on the horizon.
We've just been talking about the need for everyone from a very young age to be right up with their abilities, their capacity to use IT. Is the country's infrastructure, and I'm talking here about the ultra-fast broadband initiative coming, the rural broadband initiative, is it coming fast enough and is it well enough connected to allow our businesses and our households to do what they need to do?
Look, I think it is what it is, and I think, you know, it's hugely exciting in terms of what those services or what that connectivity will bring to, you know, especially if you look at rural, who have, you know, for the longest time probably had the worst experience around their ability to connect through broadband.
Despite running some of our biggest businesses.
Absolutely. And I think the rural piece of it is hugely exciting for that industry, but also for the rest of the country. You know, rural communities will be able to connect at speeds that they've never had access to, which will obviously allow a whole different dynamic to businesses, communities, households. You know, there'll be more mobility around those things because we'll be able to provide not only the fixed infrastructure, but the mobile services off the back of that. Because I think, you know, if you look at the landscape, mobility, I think, is going to be the big driver of productivity in rural. But without that fixed infrastructure, our ability to bring that is limited. And, you know, over the next two, three, four years, I think there's going to be a huge change.
Just to finish, there's the purchase of Telstra Clear, subject to regulatory approval. What's the rationale for the purchase and how are you going to convince the Commerce Commission that competition will be well served?
Okay, let me address the first piece. You know, the obviously everything is still subject to regulatory approval. You know, our rationale behind it was, you know, this is Vodafone's purchase of Telstra, or impending purchase of Telstra Clear, I think gives a huge boost to our customers and what we could offer to our customers and provide real competition to telecom. So if you take Vodafone's traditional strength in consumer, and, you know, we are seen as a consumer brand, a lot primarily based in Auckland. And if you look at Telstra Clear's legacy in New Zealand is, you know, they've got a huge business background, business and corporate, you know, in the centres that Vodafone doesn't have a huge presence, you know, primarily Wellington, Christchurch. So we believe that if you combine the two businesses, they're hugely complementary. There aren't many areas where we overlap the services that we provide. And what we see is, you know, a very exciting opportunity to give our customers, you know, Vodafone's legacy in mobile and what we have achieved there in terms of the future of mobility, but combining that with Telstra Clear's amazing legacy around their fixed assets and the way they do business, it's hugely exciting for customers. And we see you know, a lot of possibilities there.
In the competition argument, ipso facto, is then you are rounded enough to take on the other major competitor, as opposed to three becoming two.
Yes.
When's the decision due?
Look, I can't give you an update on that because I'm not involved directly in the process. But, you know, it's impending, is what we're told. I think it's a matter of weeks away.
You still having fun?
Oh, absolutely. You know, every day is a new challenge. It's a hugely exciting industry and it's moving at such a pace that, you know, it's never, one day is never the same to the other. So
we'll have to get this podcast to lots of primary and secondary schools. Thanks for coming in, talking to us, Sandra Pickering, who is Technology Director for Vodafone.